This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You are about to witness an evolution. On each episode, we will take a deep dive into the career of a legendary wrestling superstar, looking at all of the elements that led to and contributed to their long-term success. With your host, Andy Atherton.
Place to Be Nation Wrestling Network, after a brief hiatus, or a bit of a longer hiatus, I don't know, for this show we're quarterly, so a hiatus is a hiatus, not something that I wanted to do, but just stuff happens, and wanted to make sure I had this special guest I have tonight on Evolution. That's I'm Andy Atherton, by the way. Welcome back. This is, I believe, my fifth episode, I want to say. I'm not sure. Like I said, it's been a while, but I have a very special guest and a wrestler whose career I really am looking forward to breaking down. One of my personal favorites, so I was really happy when my guest picked this one. So this guy, though, he's here. He's from the other side of the pond. That narrows it down to one of three, I think, to your listening guesses. But he is part of Special Relations. He is part of NWA Crock and Roll. He is part of so many shows here on the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Network. He appears on Place to Be Pop Experience. He'll make pop-ups here and there, everywhere. My friend, your friend, from the great country of Scotland, Callum McDougall. Callum, welcome to Evolution.
Thank you very much, Andy. Thank you for that introduction. I am delighted to be here, so thank you for extending the invite. I've been looking forward to this one. This one for a while as well. As soon as we decided who to do,
a few months ago.
And then one thing or another kept us from doing it. So finally, real life's taken a back seat. Thankfully, and we can get it done.
Yeah. It's worth waiting for to really, you know, this is a wrestler that really should be covered in like the first like 5 to 10 episodes. No. Like obviously people see the write up, they know who we're going to talk about, but like to kind of build it up a little more. This is somebody though who would be in the first 5 to 10 episodes. If I didn't, I would be remiss. When I did, I don't always participate in the GWE year long projects, but I did participate in the greatest WWE wrestler of all time. This was my number one. Because just really love the career, one of my top three favorites of all time. And I really am excited to know and hear your thoughts as we break down the career. So, Callum, whose career are we going to break down on this show?
Well, for anyone who has listened to the Special Relations, they know that I, in particular, always reference one particular DVD. It is legendary on the Special Relations. This man took part in my number one match of all time in the GWWE match list. It is the Heartbreak Kid, Shawn Michaels.
Oh, yes. My number one on the wrestler list. I love this guy. I loved him since the early days in the Rockers. I don't know. We'll talk about it in a minute. What I don't know much about his pre-WWF career, but he just was a guy that if I had the talent or ability, you know, he's the kind of wrestler I would want to be, like a guy who was a flyer, who could jump around the ring and just a guy, you know, had charisma, oozes charisma, and can put on a match. I think probably, I think he's the greatest worker in the history of wrestling, personally. But that's just my opinion. Callum, how come, you know, what really drew you to Shawn Michaels as a, when you first started watching wrestling?
Well, when I first started watching wrestling, it was after Shawn had he was retired at the time. So I remember my first experience of Shawn Michaels was actually when he was the he was an unlockable character in SmackDown 2. And he was this sort of, he had this air of mystery about him for me. He was this guy that was always bigged up as this legend, but I'd never ever seen wrestle. And then when he came back in 2002, mm-hmm. I was intrigued to think, because they were talking about this guy that had been out for 4 years, and but he's one of the best ever to step in a WWF ring. And then I saw the match with Triple H at SummerSlam, and that was me. I was hooked on him. Go back and look at that point. I'm going back to look at older stuff. You see some stuff from 97, 98, or even as back as 96, as a singles guy, and it was just everything he touched, more often than not, when he was in the right frame of mind, when he touched something, it was going to be good. And then that whole run from 2002 onwards, it was unbelievable that this guy had been out with a career-ending back injury, could barely get himself out of bed, if you believe what he says, how bad his back was right at the very start, to putting on matches that were consistently good against loads of different guys of different experience levels. He was getting good matches out of Chris Masters and stuff, and the guy was, at that point you knew by that point I knew how good he was. It was just all, it was all post, like, his second run that got me in. His second run got me into his first run.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was pretty amazing. I was upset when he announced his retirement with the back injury, and I couldn't believe he came back. And then just the level he was able to perform. He did have to kind of change his style a little bit. You know, he still did some flying, still jumping around, but not as much, and was a lot more, was less reckless, I guess, in his thing. He was, he knew what to do in the ring. And yeah, and he is Mr. WrestleMania. So many memorable matches, elevate everybody, no matter who they were, what level they were, what stage of their career was. I mean, we'll talk about the Ric Flair match. I mean, that's one of the greatest matches, you know, at WrestleMania. That was incredible, with such an emotional finish to it. Yeah, I mean, yeah, whether you loved him or hated him, you reacted to him. You know, he brought that out of you. You felt for him. You hated him. You rooted for him. You booed him. Yeah, he just emoted and was just everything there was. In my opinion. So we're starting out, and thank God in the wrestling video games. Well, thank God he changed his finisher to Sweet Chin Music, because I remember playing I don't know if it was Nintendo, I think it was Sega. The Sega Royal Rumble, where he still had that kind of like that back suplex thing move was one of his finishers. He had that in that game, and I hated that move, by the way. I did. It was like kind of like an angle slam almost, but not as good. Nothing wrong with the angle slam. I think Kurt, that was a tremendous finisher for Kurt. But Sean, mm-hmm. I just didn't like it. You know, we'll talk about Sweet Chin Music a lot tonight, because it's again, you know, I know, I mean, Evolution, what I try to do on this show is bring somebody in who's a super fan, basically, and they talk about their favorite wrestler. So it's going to be a love fest. We're going to gush about it. But, you know, again, if we ever did a GWE or greatest wrestler finisher or move or whatever, Sweet Chin Music is up there, because he just, a lot of guys do the super kick, and a lot do them well. The Usos, Rikishi, even their dad. So many guys did the Bucks, they're okay. I crap on the Bucks, but theirs isn't bad. A lot of guys do the super kick, but Sean's is just on another level.
It's one of these ones. It's the Usos and the Young Bucks, they might do it because, well, Shawn Michaels popularized it. So these guys have grown up watching Shawn Michaels, and he can do it. But I think we'll talk about it more. But it was one of these ones that the to me anyway, a good finisher is one that can doesn't need a lot of build up. It can happen out of nowhere, like the RKO. It can happen out of nowhere, and it's just in a split second, it's done. Shelton Benjamin in 2005 being the prime example. Just can be hit anywhere from anywhere. So it's just to think at one point that was the sweet chin music was the setup for the teardrop suplex is quite amazing to think of all these years later.
Mm-hmm. All right, so he was born Michael Sean Hickenbottom on July 22nd, 1965 in Chandler, Arizona. He was the last of four children. Was a military family. He moved around quite a bit. Never liked the name Michael, so he was always called Sean. That's where he got his ring name. Basically, he wanted to become a professional wrestler as early as the age 12. Performed a wrestling routine in his high school talent show, complete with fake blood. He was a standout football player in Randolph High School in Texas. And he attended Southwest Texas State in San Marcos, Texas, but then realized college wasn't for him, began pursuing a wrestling career. He began to train under professional wrestler Jose Lothario. During his training, he adopted the ring name Shawn Michaels. After his training, he debuted as Shawn Michaels in the NWA's Mid-South Wrestling on October 16th, 1984. He performed in his debut match, it impressed so many veterans, including Terry Taylor. He then debuted in 1985 for WCCW, an NWA territory in Dallas. He went to work for another NWA territory in Kansas City, Central States Wrestling. Basically, you know, he worked his way up through the local promotions. And then he meets up with his future tag team partner, Marty Jannetty, and they beat the Batten Twins for the NWA Central States Tag Team Championship, and then loses it back to them. He then goes on to Texas All-Star Wrestling, where he was teaming with Paul Diamond in the American Breed Tag Team. They went on to win the TASW Tag Team Championship, and then was later named American Force when they feuded with Japanese Force. He then goes to the AWA at the age of 20, and he teams again with Mario Jannetty, and they're this time billed as the Midnight Rockers, and they win the AWA World Tag Team Championships, defeating Doug Summers and Buddy Rose in 1987. Then they were signed by a competing promotion, the WWF. They were fired 2 weeks later for a bar incident and a misunderstanding, according to Sean. They then returned to the AWA, where they won the AWA Tag Team titles for a second time, but then re-signed by WWF a year later. So, Calum, how familiar are we with his early years before we really knew who he was on a national level? You know, I had heard, you know, I growing up, you know, I started watching wrestling when I was about 12, 13 years old. So around WrestleMania 2. So I knew of him, but I didn't know a lot of like history. Like I didn't, you know, I had one friend who knew some of the other promotions like AWA, NWA and all that stuff. But I had heard that they were known as the Midnight Rockers, but I just didn't know anything about them. Are you familiar? Now, you started watching, you know, around 2002. Have you gone back and seen any of this? I don't know if it's anywhere except for maybe YouTube, but how familiar are you with early Sean's career?
Well, the first exposure I had of Sean pre-WWF was on the Shawn Michaels From the Vault DVD. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the... It's an excellent DVD, and I've gushed over it more than one occasion, to the point where Rory and Ben are sick to the back teeth of me talking about it. there was only one match on that one that didn't make it onto my GWWE list, and it was because it was a match from the AWA with Doug Summers and Buddy Rose. And looking at what the AWA, or the perception of the AWA and what I've seen of it, is this match was so out of place. You had these two guys, and or at least four guys, and it was just like this bloody brawl, out of control tag match. It was excellent. And I'm just thinking, in 1986, 87 time, the AWA is not in the best of shape, not certainly in the worst of shape it would ever be, but not what it had been. And you've got these two young guys, early 20s, and they would have been just so different. So I can see why, and looking at it, at the WWF tag division at that point, you can see why they would have had, they would have been prime candidates to go to WWF at that point. They would have fit right in. But Sean always seems to have a misunderstanding with people that end up with him getting a bad reputation. So I've not seen a lot of pre WWF other than his AWA stuff. Doing my research before I came on, I was surprised to hear that he'd been in Central States and particularly World Class. I wasn't expecting to see World Class come on his CV. And I know that he doesn't speak too kindly of his time in Alabama between his WWF runs. They went to, I think he, for some reason they chose Alabama over going back to the AWA. And I think it lasted for about, again, 3 weeks, and they probably had another misunderstanding and got the heave ho from there. But they did have some good stuff. I think the run with the Rockers run with Summers and Rose, certainly a bright spot at that point in the AWA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was excited to see him. I am not familiar at all with his early work. I mean, there was an excellent biography where he talked about it a bit, and they did go into it a little bit on, you know, earlier this year on A&E. You should check that out. But the Rockers, like, I was always partial to this team because as much as I loved, you know, Bruisers and all that, I mean, honestly, the British Bulldogs are the reason why I got really into wrestling at WrestleMania 2. I know that's a show that's kind of maligned. I mean, well, it's kind of polarizing. Some people either really love it or they're like, oh, that's not a great show. But the Rockers are probably my number two or three tag team of all time. You know, you got to put the LOD up there. You know, and then the Bulldogs, really. So they come in. Wait, before we move on, though, do you know anything about the incident that got them fired from WWF at the time? Did you hear anything? Have you?
The only thing I know is that they were they went to a bar after a show one night, mm-hmm. and thought they were. And as Sean tends to do, runs his mouth. And they thought they were. I think they thought they were a bit more important than they actually were. And they were brought down. They were brought down a peg or two. They rubbed the wrong people up the wrong way. Now, for the life of me, I can't remember who it was they rubbed up the wrong way. But certainly, they weren't endearing themselves to their new colleagues.
Yeah. Yeah, you've heard so many stories. Wrestler Court, you know, the boys in the back. You know, these were new guys. They were flashy. You know, they were so 80s. You know, with the long hair, the long earrings. You know, flashy. You know, they look like, you know, they could be in Whitesnake or Twisted Sister or whatever, Bon Jovi. You know, these guys were so 80s. And they were just, you know, they were just signed, so, you know, they're like that punk, like, you know, quarterback that gets drafted and comes in and you know, is kind of mouthy to the veterans, and then, you know, he finds his, like, you know, finds himself, like locked out during training camp with wearing just his jock strap kind of thing. But, yeah, they went pretty extreme, though, I mean, for them to get fired. So I'm sure that it was somebody with a lot of power, a lot of play, and Vince probably did not take too kindly. But, you know, saw talent in them. He re-signed them, and they re-debuted on July 7th, 1988 as the Rockers. They changed, Vince McMahon changed their name because, you know, he has to, you know, have WWF exclusive to his ring name. So they're simply the Rockers. I still to this day dig their theme music. They were really popular. They did these double team maneuvers that you never really had seen before. They were just in sync. I mean, you had the blonde guy, the brunette guy. They wore matching things, the way they got in and out of the ring. They just were incredible. What do you think of the Rockers? What are your initial thoughts on the tag team?
I think they were absolutely fantastic. They were of their time, but they were also slightly ahead of their time as well, mm-hmm. if that can even make sense.
Yeah, no, it makes sense.
they fit in perfectly to that. As you say, they were so 80s. I mean, they would just go. It doesn't matter who they were with, they would have, it would be difficult for the Rockers not to have a good match, just by how good the two of them were. But I include Marty in that as well, because he was, as part of that team, he was excellent. And he always got in the way of himself. Mm-hmm. But like, so you think of some of the matches they had, like the Orient Express matches, Power and Glory, mm-hmm. the Brainbusters, like all these different types of teams, and they would just knock it out of the park every single time with them. But they had the whole package, as you say, the music. You knew exactly who it was that was coming through the curtain, their look, and everything between the bells was just superb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you didn't have a team of guys that, you know, really were flyers, and guys that were just both like so like good in a ring technically. I mean, a lot of the times he was either like, you had like a big team like the LOD, you had two technicians like the Brainbusters, or you had that like the technician and the big guy, which was the Hart Foundation. You know, you had the guys who were power guys, but had some good speed. That was the Bulldogs. I mean, they were something like you didn't really see them. They were unique. Like today, like you see, like you said, the Rockers would fit in today. They would have fit in, you know, in the early 2000s. A lot of people copy them, like we said, like the Bucks. I think the Young Bucks are what would happen if the Rockers and the Hardys had a baby, basically. I mean, but they are spot monkeys, in my opinion. But anyway, we're not talking about them.
I can't wait for somebody to pick the Young Bucks on a future episode.
God, I hope not. I mean, maybe one day, but we'll see how long the show goes, if it'll be long enough to get the Young Bucks an episode. But I dug the Power and Glory feud. The match with the Orange Spash, that, you know, those matches were great. Their matches with the Hearts always delivered. Yeah, even like, you know, in the Survivor Series when they were together. How come though? I mean, they did win the tag championships unofficially, mm-hmm. but how come you think they never held the belts like officially, like on TV?
I don't know. I wonder if it's because you've won. It's not like today where they've got four lots of tag belts at a minimum. I think with that point they had so much talent. I think they may have just been a victim of circumstance. So they had 88, they had the Hart Foundation, and then you go into 89 and they think they could do it then, but you've got the Brainbusters coming in, and then you've got the LOD coming in, and I think there was always just this new big potential, just this new big acquisition that was getting it ahead of them. You've also potentially got the thing where maybe a Jake or a Jim Duggan issue where they think that the perception is that they don't need the belts. I don't know, because they were very, very popular. Mm-hmm. maybe they thought they didn't need the belts. They'd be popular regardless. So like, yeah, it was strange that they never got the official run.
Yeah, it would have been nice. I mean, yeah, like you said though, the Rockers didn't need the belts per se, but you know, you look at some of the teams that have held belts, and you could say the Rockers never officially held a belt. What is happening here? I always had liked Marty as well. I thought, you know, Sean was the flashier. Marty was the, I thought Marty was the better worker back then. You know, but like you mentioned, Marty's demons, and he just can never get out of his own way. And I've heard rumors, I don't know how true it is, but was Marty the one that was supposed to get the push initially? But, you know, they just knew that he was, you know, they wasn't going to be able to count on the guy? Or what do you think? Do you think Marty should have been the one that came out? I mean, well, looking back, obviously they made the right choice, but, you know.
Yeah, well, it might have been, because you've got, if you look at the way that they, if you look at the way that they split up, something there's something in the back of my head telling me that I have heard that as well. If you look at the way they split up, it's made for Marty to come back with this massive, massive comeback, and potentially, and then by the point he's going to come back, Sean's Intercontinental Champion. So it could be that. It could be that they were priming Marty for the big run, and a sliding doors moment. They did potentially didn't know what they had with Sean. I mean, that could have been
so good, such an asshole.
It could have been
a hockey heel.
I know, but it could have been if Marty had his head on straight. Shawn Michaels, the Heartbreak Kid, might not have become what he was today. It's very strange to think about, but I totally agree with you that when you say that, well, Marty could potentially have been the better worker. I think they're very, very similar in terms, well, during the Rocker's time anyway, in ring. And I've been on a couple of episodes of Senior Video with Rory, where we've seen Rocker's matches on these Coliseum tapes, and Marty is every bit as good in them. There was one match in particular with the Rougeaus in Paris, and Marty was, the four of them were going hell for leather that night, but Marty was every bit as good as Sean in that match, and so, you know, we could have been, if it had gone differently, we could have been sitting here tonight talking about how Marty Jannetty was my favourite wrestler of all time.
Yeah, well, I mean, you look at other teams like, you know, the Rock and Roll Express. You know, when I watch Rock and Roll Express matches, I always think Robert Gibson's the better wrestler. I mean, Morton was the Flash, you know. Mm-hmm. He had the more personality, I guess, of the two guys. But yeah, that I kind of equate them the same way, where Robert Gibson and Marty Jannetty, I would put them in the same category. Like, they were the better workers in the team, but not the better I guess characters. Mm-hmm. who were able to put it together. But we kind of jumped forward a little bit. Arguably, people consider their breakup one of the greatest heel turns of all time. You know, it was on the Barbershop. Sean was showing heel tendencies. He was starting to kind of be an asshole, and there was a lot of dissension in the Rockers, a team that, you know, was, you know, they were more in sync than any team you had ever seen at that time. You know, not saying like Demolition, you know, the British Bulldogs or whoever, Hearts, were not in sync. These guys, you know, just were like, you thought these guys were going to be together forever, kind of. That was the vibe that the Rockers emitted. But then Sean started to act a little heelish and stuff, and started dressing a little different. And then they appear, you know, on the Barbershop, and we get that, you know, great hug. You know, we're going to rock and roll, strut and stroll. And, you know, and they held their hands up, and Brutus says, "Ladies and gentlemen, the Rockers," and they put their hands down, and Sean just gives him a freaking super kick like you wouldn't believe. And then, you know, the place starts booing him. I mean, obviously it was a taped episode of Superstars. Could you imagine today a heel turn of that magnitude being done on a tape show, no less? Throws him through the glass, and then rips up the WWF magazine with the Rockers on it. Now, Callum, when you went back and watched this for the first time, what was your reaction?
Oh, it's one of the, to me, it's one of the best heel turns that they've ever done. Every bit of it just seemed excellent, and you can looking at it now, you can see that there is the first wee, as you said, he'd had the heel tendencies, but there was the first indication that of the Heartbreak Kid coming through, where he was just his mannerisms through the whole thing, right up into the super kick. Mm-hmm. And then throwing him through the window. But there's the soundtrack to it as well. You have Bobby.
Oh God! I knew he was gonna do that.
Yeah, he's like, oh, this is terrible. This is awful to watch. Oh, I knew he was gonna do that. And then, oh, Marty Jannetty, what a coward! He's thrown himself through that window to get away from Shawn Michaels. Bobby makes it. It just adds that wee something extra. But I think Brutus in it was even really good, because he was selling utter disbelief at what he saw. He couldn't, as soon as he hits the super kick, he was in the background in shock. It was just so well done. And as you say, to do it on a tape show, what a different time that would have been. I'm trying to equate something that obviously not on a grander scale, but or not on the same scale. But if you like, when Seth Rollins turned on the Shield, could you imagine them doing that on a tape Raw? It just came out of nowhere. So stuff like this now, they would wait. They would wait to make sure it was done live. But it was absolutely excellent.
It was a different time. I mean, we didn't have all the cable channels. We didn't have the internet. So that stuff, you know, would make the sheets. I mean, it would get, you know, leaked out. And then my friend was getting the mail newsletter and all that stuff. And I would hear stuff from him. But yeah, you really, I mean, it was one of the local papers growing up. It's still around. I think it was the Daily News and the New York Post. They had a guy that would write a wrestling column. And he didn't have a name. He had like some alias, like The Mask, whatever. And he, but you never got spoilers. That was a great time, actually, you know, because you love being surprised. That genuine, like, you're not expecting it. You know, you never saw it coming. Just so great. And yeah, no. I could just imagine, I've been to two Superstars tapings in my life, and I could just imagine, hopefully they did that, later in the show, because I don't know if I would have been able to, like, settle down, like, the rest of the night after seeing that live. Because those are long tapings. They would tape, like, I think 4 or 5 weeks worth of shows. So.
Yeah, it would need to be, I remember I went to a Raw taping when they were over here, and it was 3-4 hours, and by the end of it we were spent. So I can't imagine doing these epic 5-hour Superstars tapings. So I hope they did it right at the very start. And then
one was okay, because I had second or third row, you could actually see me. It was right after we recorded it was taped, like, right around SummerSlam 93, so you could see me, and we're hard camera too. So you could see my face, like, the entire time on these episodes. But the other one, I was at the Mid-Hudson Civic Center. And that place is, not a great area. It was hot and stuffy. And just the seats were not nearly as good. And just made the night, like, go on and on. I honestly couldn't even remember what matches were on that night. that's also a bit of a drive from where I grew up. So the Westchester County Center was about 20 minutes. Mid-Hudson Civic Center was about an hour and a half. So it was quite a difference.
I can imagine.
Yeah, so he becomes the Heartbreak Kid, and they partner up with Sensational Sherry, and he gets a brand new theme song sung by Sherry. And they do, basically, he's just the sexy boy. He's got, you know, primp and prop, you know, he's got the hair, he's got the chaps, you know, the mirror she carries around. His departure was announced that Shawn Michaels has left the building. What did you think of this character change for Shawn?
I think it was sort of an extension to the Rockers, but it was dialed up that wee bit more to 11. But it seemed to suit him, brilliantly, it was an absolute stroke of genius to put him with Sensational Sherry. Whoever thought of that idea didn't get paid enough, because the two of them as a partnership were excellent. But I think it got a bit of mileage out of the Heartbreak Kid character, but I think it was one of these ones that I think Steve Austin always says it, the best characters in wrestling are always the ones that are just an exaggerated version of yourself. And I do think that at that time, the Heartbreak Kid was just Shawn Michaels dialed up to 11.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then he, starts, moving up, the card rather quickly to the mid card. He gets in the Intercontinental title. He wins it on, he wins it from the Bulldog on Saturday Night's Main Event in, 1992. Was he won? Yeah, I'm trying to look through my notes. And then
late 92.
Yeah. Late 92. He wins that. And then he, starts wrestling, his start of his feud with Brett starts to his longtime, not a feud, let's say rivalry. It starts off, he has, great matches with Mr. Perfect. He, what do you think of when him and Sherry didn't last that long? Do you think they did all they could in a short amount of time? Or do you think they could have kept going with her?
I think they could have kept going with Sherry. It was a strange one. I don't really know what the end goal with that would have been when he went to because I think is it WrestleMania 9 he comes out with Luna. It's like it's all very. I don't know where they were. I don't know what the end goal was with that was, but I think they could have gone for for a lot longer with Sean and Sherry, as a partnership.
Yeah, but I do kind of like what his next partnership is. They signed Kevin Nash. Fresh off having some of the shittiest gimmicks in the history of the world in WCW. Comes in as the bodyguard, Diesel, adds another layer to this. Sean to me is kind of like his heel turn was like he was in a band and he was the lead singer and just became so full of himself, after they got some fame. And that's kind of what Sean seemed like to me. Like he had the girl and then, no, let's get serious. I need somebody that's really going to watch my back. And Nash's Diesel was perfect for that, perfect for the chicken shit heel, the guy that, needs the big man behind him to keep his belt. He had the time, he had his feud with Marty finally, and where he, goes back and forth with the championship. And then he, ends up testing positive. In September 93, he was suspended for testing positive for a steroid, a charge he never admitted. They stripped the belt off of him. And then he gets some advances from WCW, but then turns him down, amazingly. You would never have thought he would have done that because of, what happens later on in a couple of years. But, he comes in and comes back after a brief suspension and has, great feuds here. He steps in for Jerry Lawler at the Survivor Series. And then in 94, he enters a rivalry with his buddy Razor Ramon and has that arguably one of the greatest ladder matches of all time at WrestleMania 10. So what did you think of him now coming back and talk about the first time you saw that ladder match?
He's 93. He had a really good match with Jannetty on Raw. And then a massively underwhelming match with Mr. Perfect at SummerSlam. And these are two guys that you would think would be ideal partners for each other. But sometimes I watch that match and just wonder what could have been. They seem to have anti-chemistry, which is staggering for guys that are two guys that are as good as Mr. Perfect and Shawn Michaels are. But I think them, it's been said a few times that Shawn wasn't in the best of shape at that point. Maybe not in the best frame of mind at that point either. A recurring theme that'll follow him through the 90s. But partnering him up with Diesel was a stroke of genius, and I think the story is that did Sean see him on Sean see him as Vinny Vegas on WCW and put a he phoned. There was somebody that I can't remember off the top of my head now, but he phoned somebody to see if Nash was available. And I think we spoke about it on the Kevin Nash broken skull session on the last special relations. Nash was WCW didn't care really much about Kevin Nash. He walked in. Ole Anderson was the booker at the time, and he walked in to see if he could get his release. And Nash was saying that the story was that Ole Anderson didn't look up. Nash walked in with his release papers. Ole didn't look up from his desk, what he was doing, signed it and handed it back to him. And he was going in expecting this fight. And then the next week or a couple of nights later, he's walking out with Shawn Michaels at a house show. Every single step of the way, it seems Sean's had the best luck. He was partnered with Sherry, who brought him on to the next level, and the partnership with Diesel was just, it seemed like the two of them were tailor made for each other. The first time I saw the ladder match was on the Shawn Michaels From the Vault DVD, and obviously I started watching wrestling properly in February 2001, so about 6 weeks before the first TLC match, and that's taken. So that was the first benchmark introduction that I had to a variation of the ladder match. Mm-hmm. But you look back, looking back on the first one at 10, and you can see that everything that those guys did, they laid the foundations for every ladder match that has come since. If that one doesn't happen, you don't have, it's very easy to say, you don't have TLC, you don't have the Hardys and throwing themselves off of ladders and all these things. But I still think that we're watching, it was 27 years ago. Mm-hmm. I still think the match holds up today. It's a work of art.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So he loses the match though to Razor. They had both belts above there. And then him and Diesel starts to get in a ring. I remember seeing during his time at Superstars, it was Diesel had just come in, and I remember seeing, I forgot who Sean wrestled against that night. I remember he basically won a squash, and then they beat the crap out of the 1-2-3 kid on his way into the next match, and that's that ignited something there. Then him and Diesel, they win the tag titles from the Head Shrinkers at SummerSlam. Right before SummerSlam. The next day, Diesel lost the Intercontinental Championship to Razor Ramon when he accidentally super kicked them. That leads to the split, that culminates, he gets drawn out until about Survivor Series, when Big Daddy Cool, didn't he walk out on him or something like that? Sean was being a real asshole basically to his team, Razor and the kid were on the other team. And then the next day, Diesel's monster year starts when he wins. He beats Backlund in like 20 seconds or something like that. But then they set up, the grudge between the two of them, good friends, better enemies, I guess, right? Is that what's going on at the time?
Yeah, yes, it would have been, because Good Friends, Better Enemies was Sean's first defense after he won the
period of time that was,
but yeah,
that was,
that's,
yeah, that yeah. time. And then then they also bring Sid in at that time. So what was your thought of his, you know, the breakup of him and Diesel and leading up to their match?
It's very strange, but also you can absolutely see it was perfectly timed as well. It's because Diesel, as JT has said on other things, the Royal Rumble 1994 really set Diesel on a path that I don't think many people were expecting, because he just laid waste to people in the Rumble.
A spot, like basically a role in the Rumble after him, like who gets the Diesel push this year?
Yeah. So I think people gravitated towards him after that. So I think it's they wanted to go in the direction with Diesel, because I mean you look at that guy and you just know that he's Vince McMahon's wet dream.
Yeah.
So it's not a surprise that Diesel went in the way that he did. I think it was a very canny move to have Sean. If you're going to have somebody win the Royal Rumble from number one, Sean's probably your guy to do it, because you know that he'll put in a performance that makes you think that it's possible but unlikely, because he'll just sneak his way to it. And eventually he did, with the 1 foot touching the floor. I think Sean was the perfect, at that point, other than maybe Owen Hart, Sean was the perfect person to pull that off. And knowing that your main event is going to involve Lawrence Taylor, having Sean in the title match with Diesel, That was a smart bit of booking there, because you know you're going to get a good match right before the main event, which you don't know. I mean, that could have turned into a car crash. They were very fortunate that it didn't. But so having Sean there was probably an excellent decision. Made even better, because you know what his attitude being a problem, and Kevin Nash, you know, comes across an easygoing type of guy, but you can tell that when he gets pissed off, you can tell. You put them and you add the wee bit of fire that they're not happy that they're going on last, or they're not going on last at WrestleMania. You're mixing a pot that you're going to get a good match.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what? From this time period, what do you think his signature feud is?
From this time period, you can't look beyond Razor, because it has a lot of the year is with a lot of 94 was with Razor. And then he goes in his summer vacation and becomes Diesel's manager over the summer. And then you come back into 95, he wins the Rumble, and then he's wee bit with Diesel. So I think it's predominantly anything to do with the Click would be his headline feud, because we didn't talk about it. Back in 94, obviously they had the excellent Action Zone tag match. Mm-hmm. So I think it's anything involving the Click at this point. Just before we move on to he moves on to the next stage of his career, I would say.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite match of this time period? The ladder match.
Yeah, the ladder mm-hmm. match. I mean, he has a very good match with Jeff Jarrett in Your House too, but the ladder match is just, even still, as I said, 27 years later, it's still a work of art. It's still the full 5 stars for me.
Yeah. All right. So you know, he takes some time off. Well, he gets attacked by Sid. After recruits him, and he takes time off because Vince McMahon wants him to become a fan favorite. So, you know, he makes his triumphant return in May of 95. He goes on to defeat Jeff Jarrett to win the Intercontinental title again. Then he, you know, has a title defense against Razor at SummerSlam later that year, which he wins. And then he, the little change happens backstage. He becomes the leader of a group, you know, backstage known as the Click, made up of, you know, Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, a.k.a. Razor, 123 Kid Shawn Waltman, and Hunter Hearst Helmsley, a.k.a. Triple H, Paul Levesque. And really started to kind of, you know, not run roughshod, but they were, you know, had a little power back there. You know, he gets he has a little issue outside the ring where he gets beat up of he gets basically assaulted outside a bar in Syracuse. And then he you know, is out of it for a little, has to be, you know, out of action for a bit and, you know, forced to forfeit his Intercontinental Championship to Dean Douglas, who in turn loses it to Razor. You know, this is people have said this is an example of the Click holding others down, a.k.a. Douglas. And then, you know, he goes up against Owen in an episode of Raw in November. And Ninsegiri hits him in the back of the head, but Michaels collapsed in the ring, supposedly having suffered a concussion, but it was scripted, which was kept from most fans. And then he goes on to have a retirement angle, which was written so that he could take some time off because he came back from his injury a wee bit too soon. So what do you think of his return as a face here?
I thought it was very well done. I think with watching the match with Diesel at WrestleMania 11, you can tell that the fans were wanting to cheer him. I think it's when you have the in-ring style that Shawn was had at this point in time, it does tend to be more of a babyface way of working. Mm-hmm. So bringing him back was sort of putting him on that. You bring him back and you put him on the. I think at that point, you would know that he's on the trajectory to be the next the next face of the company.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's giving the fans what they want isn't always the worst thing. I think they've got away from that recently, but at that point in time, these fans wanted to cheer Shawn Michaels, then we'll make Shawn Michaels a face. That's easiest way around that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and what are your thoughts on the Click, basically, as a unit, as kind of, I mean, we hear stories. I mean, they, you know, we talk about stuff on you know, Broken Skull and all those other things. What are your thoughts on the Click? As a off camera group, I guess, because they don't really, they never have them all together. They have hints here, they have three here, two here, whatever, but they never have them all together. Never happened in time. I don't know if they were all under contract again at the same time. Maybe later on after WCW folds, but not during this time period.
It's one of these things. Like, you can. In any place of work, you're going to have people that you like and you're going to have people that you don't like. You're never going to get on with everybody in any social setting. More often than not, there'll be somebody that rubs you the wrong way or you think he's a bit of an arsehole. 9 times out of 10, Shawn Michaels is that arsehole. But they rub people the wrong way, but in that industry, and I've said this, and people talk about Triple H's reign of terror, and if you think it's on the tip of my tongue, but it's an industry where you always need to watch your back and nothing is ever guaranteed. So Shawn may be on the trajectory to be the next face of the company, but on a whim, Vince McMahon can change his mind and it's going to be Bret Hart, it's going to be Razor Ramon. You don't, they just don't know. So you're all, in that industry, you can I can understand why you would want to politic your way to make sure that the boss sees you in the best light, because it's the difference between having an potentially the difference between having an extra zero in the end of your paycheck. Some of the things that I've heard, Titan Sinking, the Titan Sinking book, which covers 1995, is very good. It goes into a lot of detail about the Click, and you hear guys like Bob Hawley thinking he was getting held down by the Click. Bob Hawley's lack of talent probably held him down more than Shawn Michaels
yes.
did. And Dean Douglas didn't get on with him, but you know, Shane Douglas himself is no saint. You know, it's chalk and cheese. They were never going to get on. So I can 100% believe that they were going to be that Shawn especially would be difficult to work with, and he would politic his way. But I think that's just the nature of the business that guys feel that they need to do. I mean, you've got Hulk Hogan who would the master politicker. I mean, so it's not just a Click thing that turned up in the WWF in the mid 90s.
Yeah, it was just one that, like, you know, we knew about that, you know, you didn't realize, you know. A lot, they kept hidden pretty good. Like, you didn't know, like, what was the name of that, of the Undertaker's whole crew, like him and Yoko, and
the Bone Street crew.
Yeah, the Bone Street, you know, and you knew, like, for years, like, I never would put two and two together and thought Hogan and Brian Knobs were close and shit like that. You know, you always knew that him and Brutus were close, but yeah. You just never know.
No, I think it's just because Shawn Michaels was so... It's because of the way that he was at the time that the Click became so notorious. But I certainly don't think they were was it an Undertaker documentary that the Bone Street crew, they saw themselves as sort of like the locker room police to keep the Click under control. But I think because of who was involved, the Click would probably be more notorious. But I can't believe that there's never been stuff like that before or since.
Yeah, I'm sure that stuff has gone on, probably still goes on. I mean, you know, different locker room leaders. I think it's because, you know, a lot of times, you know, when you think of like the Undertaker, the Bone Street crew, whatever, you know, they were like they kept the peace. You know, they looked out for the boys and, you know, the business and all that stuff and the whole wrestler court thing. But, you know, these were just five guys that like ran together, you know, thought they were hot shit, and they were. But, you know, I guess, and that probably rubbed a lot of, you know, some of the old school guys the wrong way. That's really what it was, I think.
I'm in no way defending the way they acted, because they did make life miserable for a lot of people. I mean, Bam Bam Bigelow was ready to retire. He couldn't wait to leave. So, they were real assholes. Backstage. So I'm in no way defending it, but I can somewhat understand it, if it's probably the best way to describe it.
Yeah. So we talked a lot more backstage than we normally talk, because with this guy, I think you really do need to talk about, because, you know, there's a lot more coming too.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
but, you know, a lot of great stuff though on camera that we have to talk about. You know, we're really just scratching the surface on the Heartbreak Kid, Shawn Michaels. But we're going to take a quick break to give us a chance to collect our thoughts and give you a chance to, you know, listen to some great Shawn Michaels theme music. And then we'll just be back in just a couple of minutes, and we'll continue on our great discussion with Cal McDougall. I am Andy Atherton, and you're listening to Evolution, Shawn Michaels, the Heartbreak Kid. Be right back.
I know I'm sexy. sent chills up and down their spine. I'm just a sexy boy.
All right, Place of Nation Wrestling Network, welcome back to Evolution. We're talking about the Heartbreak Kid, Shawn Michaels, the Showstopper, the Icon, the, you know, one of the greatest of all time, with Cal McDougall, the super fan, so you will. So we left off with him, you know, taking some time off, and he, you know, had come back. You know, he was written out of TV, you know, because of a, you know, a concussion. But just, he had just come back from injury. But we're in 1996, where he returns with, you know, by the way, it's Cal McDougall. I forgot to reintroduce you to on the pod here. So Shawn comes back at the Royal Rumble, and he ends up winning it for the second year in a row. He receives a championship match at WrestleMania 12. He, you know, takes place in the famous Iron Man match, the 60-minute Iron Man match that had ended in a scoreless tie, but he wins in overtime. So we'll pause there. What do you think of his return? And kind of compare this Rumble win to the one before, and we'll, then we'll go into the Iron Man match.
This Rumble win was probably more... I would say this one was a more of a foregone conclusion than 95 was. 95, there wasn't very many people in it that you think could win. But you had Bulldog, you had Owen, who was still in the middle of his feud with Brett. So Owen was a candidate, but I think everything was gearing up for Shawn to win the Rumble in 1996. I think it was made the wee bit better that it was Diesel that he eliminated to win. But the comeback, I think they played it very well, because it was the retirement tease, and then it's almost like he's his one last run, one last go at it. He's entering the Rumble, and he's obviously goes to Mania to face Brett. In between, he does have a decent match with Owen in your house, where he's dancing on top of the in your house set, which is a moment that I don't think is played enough. I mean, it's quite a unique use of the wee house they had as the entranceway.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And then they build it up, and they do really well with building up to WrestleMania 12. They've got the training montages, and it does make it. They built it up the same way that they would do with The Rock and Brock Lesnar, where it had this proper sport feel. And they did make it like a big fight feel in the run up to the Iron Man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I like that match. I mean, I don't necessarily love it. I mean, it's a 60-minute match. I mean, you know, maybe it's my attention span, but you know, I did really pop for that moment where, you know, they played up the boyhood dream. I mean, you could see the genuine emotion on his face. Yeah, I mean. Where would you rank the Iron Man match in Shawn's legacy, his career?
It's a strange one. It's certainly not a bad match by any stretch of the imagination. And it is they do really well, and to be told that you need to go 60 minutes. Or 60-plus minutes at WrestleMania, when there's nothing like that has been done in the WWF for... Oh, I mean, when would have been the last 60-minute draw when Backlund was the champion? So you're talking at least 10 years. No, the fans are not in tune to... they're not acclimatized to that sort of match. If you have it in the AW and the NWA, then you're laughing all the way to the bank. But mm-hmm. I don't think it's helped if you have that match in New York or Chicago or any other wrestling town. It might be well more regarded. because I don't think the crowd being dead for the vast majority of it really helped. And I know that's certainly something that Rory, when you know, Rory on the special relations, we've talked about it, he does not like this match at all. And one of the reasons is the crowd just aren't into it. But I think it's a major show of respect for Sean and Brett to say that we trust you to go 60 minutes on the biggest show of the year. Go out and do it. And they certainly, for the time that they were given and knowing that they would have to go 60 minutes, they did really well. It is a good match. I don't think it's... But I do see the criticisms that people give.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So after that, we had talked about the clit a bit. Click. Oh God, I might have to go edit that. We talked about the click quite a bit, and we have basically their last hurrah, and it's known as the curtain call. It had happened at the end of a match between Diesel and Shawn Michaels had won a match at Madison Square Garden. It was a cage match. Razor Ramon and Hunter Hurst-Helmsley come down and they all embrace in a group hug at Breaking Kayfabe because, you know, two of them were faces, two of them were heels. But, you know, Diesel and Razor had signed with WCW, the beginning of the Monday Night Wars. So they weren't going to get punished. Shawn was the champion. He wasn't going to get punished. So Triple H, who was supposed to win King of the Ring that year, gets punished. And you know what? If it wasn't for the curtain call, we wouldn't have gotten Austin 3:16 because Austin wins the King of the Ring that year. And, you know, I have people that tell me things happen for a reason. I don't always believe that. But this is one of those instances where, you know, you wouldn't believe that, you know, this has affected probably one of the greatest runs of all time by another wrestler, but it kind of does. So, you know, they bring in, Sid there, and Michaels starts his feud, and it ends at the Survivor Series where he loses to Sid, and then he recaptures it at Sid at the Rumble. So, what are your thoughts on the curtain call and the run here he has with Sid?
The curtain call, it's just one of these. It's one of these. It was reasonable and professional, probably quite unprofessional. And you hear guys like Jim Cornette saying that they've just killed the business, and especially to do it in Madison Square Garden. They could have done it anywhere, but if they'd done it in the Mid-Hudson Civic Centre, would it have been as big a deal? Possibly not, because they did it in the middle of the ring in Madison Square Garden. It's sort of the outrage is sort of elevated. No one would know had that guy not taken his camcorder in, It would just be one of these mythological, it would be on the sleaze list that Tony Khan's allegedly started. It would just be one of these things that was just a potential urban myth.
Yeah.
It's just one of these things. But we were Kevin Nash, again, going back to the special relations when we did the Kevin Nash interview review. He talked about it, and he just said that you're getting this response, and it was never. He said it was never meant to be. It wasn't premeditated. It wasn't meant to be It was never meant to escalate, and it was never meant to be disrespectful or anything. Never meant to escalate to the level that it did. But you hear the crowd cheering, and your response is to. Or he said anyway that your response to the crowd cheering is to do stuff that makes the crowd cheer more. And in the moment, he didn't really realise what he was doing. But he said he was furious that Sean let Triple H take the brunt of the punishment. because he said that Shawn Michaels was never going to get punished, but he certainly was in a position to make sure that Triple H didn't. He had enough sway. But yeah, I mean, as you say there, without the curtain call, you don't get Austin 316, and we talked about that as well. It's like the butterfly effect of that whole thing. So you, if the curtain call never happens, Austin 316 never happens, Nash and Hall going to WCW, the NWO doesn't happen, and WCW might not become as big as it did. You never have the Monday Night Wars. We could still be in 2021 going around with plumbers and fucking baseball umpires in the middle of the ring. It could, you can trace back a lot of things that happened to Hall and Nash leaving the WWF, and then obviously the curtain call. So in terms of moments, then yeah, I mean it's one of, I get when people say it's one of the most disrespectful moments, but it's certainly one of the most important moments in the history of wrestling.
Oh yeah.
Sean's 96 was like, his pay-per-view appearances were excellent. I mean, he had the Diesel match at Good Friends Better Enemies, which was superb. He had a couple of good matches with the Bulldog. He had a superb match with Mankind at Mind Games, and then you go on to face his feud with the most bizarrely over man in the history, probably in the history of wrestling, where Sid, he's over for, and you can never properly explain it, but you're also always gravitate towards Sid. He's just got this aura and this X factor around him. And the match at Survivor Series 96 is fantastic. It's probably one of Sid's best ever, or if not his best ever. And it just, yeah, it was, I think at that point in time, that was the match to have, and probably the end result, because Sid at that point was ridiculously over. So no arguments from me from Sean losing the belt as early as he did.
So then we move on to a special episode of Raw, known as Thursday Raw Thursday, where Sean vacates the WWE Championship. He explained to fans that he was informed by doctors that he had conjured a knee injury and he had to retire. His speech was regarded as controversial, as rumor was that he was unwilling to lose to Bret at WrestleMania 13, since that was noted he was going to have that rematch. He had contemplated thoughts of retirement and stated that he had to find a smile again, which he had lost somehow down the line. After he does go and have knee surgery by Dr. James Andrews, Michaels returns a few months later. He briefly teams with Stone Cold Steve Austin to win the tag titles. And then, Bret, you know, the whole feud with Bret is continuing on backstage, claiming that, he was claiming that Shawn was faking the whole injury. And then in the spring, you know, it was reaching its height. Both men were going out on television, making it personal with remarks, moving into, later that year with Shawn makes the on-air remark known as the Sunny Days comment, implying that Bret was having an affair with Tammy Sitch. And then this feud really intensifies and it goes into summer, but we're going to pause right before SummerSlam. So, you know, Shawn goes out and he comes back. What do you think of Shawn losing his smile?
It's very suspect. in the first half, I came across that I was defending his behaviour as part of the clique, but at this point there's no defence for it. He was just being awkward. He was just being an arse. I think at this point, he'd had 5 title reigns in the WWF, and he'd only ever lost one of them in the ring. So like, once is unfortunate, twice is a coincidence. As soon as you go into 3 and 4 times, then you're just not wanting to do business the way it should be done. This one is probably the most egregious of the whole thing, considering who was involved. And the losing his smile thing, that was, anytime I've seen that whole that whole episode, or the whole in-ring segment, it's just, he puts on a good act, but there's just something behind it. You just don't believe him. Especially when if his knees and such, so he can barely carry his own weight going into the ring. A couple of weeks later, he's at WrestleMania and he's dancing on the table. So you can see why no one believes him, and I'm inclined to put myself in that camp as well. For everything I'll praise Shawn Michaels for, this is not one that I'm going to be able to defend, and I don't really particularly want to defend because I'll be fighting a losing battle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we get into over the year, we get into SummerSlam, which I was at actually that show, where he is the official. He was the referee for the WWF Championship match between The Undertaker and Bret Hart. It ended controversially with Shawn hitting The Undertaker with a chair unintentionally as he was aiming for Bret, who had spat in his face. He was then forced to award the championship to his nemesis. The next night on Raw, signs of a heel turn. Started the show to show, as Michaels told the fans, that what happened at SummerSlam was an accident, and he dealt with The Undertaker when the time came. And then he goes on to WWF One Night Only in September over in Birmingham, England, where he defeats the Bulldog to capture the European Championship. The fans of the event were so appalled at the result that they booed him out of the building, and he littered the ring with garbage, cementing his second heel turn. With this win, he becomes the first Grand Slam champion. Then at Your House, Bad Blood, he defeats The Undertaker in the first ever Hell in a Cell match, during which Michaels falls off the side of the high 15-foot high structure through a table. It received a 5-star rating. So let's talk about this part where, you know, we get the summertime, we get SummerSlam, which was a great match, and it told a story between these three guys, because these were your three basically lead dogs for the Monday Night Wars here. And you know, he goes over to England to win the European title. And then, the first Hell in the Cell. So talk about this period. What did you think of, the storyline with him as the ref? And then, the reaction he gets from being the hometown guy, basically, for the European belt. And then the first ever Hell in the Cell.
The whole story with him being the referee at SummerSlam was great. He can be, and at this point in time, this is probably the peak of how toxic Shawn Michaels was to be around backstage. But when he was in front of the camera, he could tell a story like no other. Him, the sort of the forced three count, where he made the third count sort of in spite of himself to have Bret win, and his reaction to that was excellent storytelling. And
mm-hmm. the way they're looking at each other right in the eyes, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And the whole lead up to it with the chair shot, it was excellent. They worked. And then it moves on, has the really good match with, well, I think it's really good anyway, really good match with The Undertaker on a really bad show at Ground Zero. And you're sort of going towards, and then obviously you're going to have the issue where Bret thinks that he's, because Shawn's going heel, he's stealing his spot, and it's quite hard to argue that he's not. And then the whole thing with One Night Only, that is, that is the peak of Shawn Michaels being if you were to point to a moment where what was the worst that Shawn Michaels ever got, it was One Night Only. He did that out of, there was no good reason for him to win the European Championship that night. The whole build up was that Bulldog was doing it for his sister who was dying of cancer. He was doing it out of the last time the Bulldog had been in the UK. Or in a match to this extent was SummerSlam 1992. There was no need for Shawn Michaels to win that one. Again, this is another one you can't defend. Shawn did it because he wanted to get one over on Bret Hart. And the European title was a trophy. It was a trinket for the Bulldog. At that point in time, there was no need. Like, Shawn Michaels didn't need the European Championship. Shawn Michaels was weeks away from winning. Was weeks away from winning the WWF title again. There was. It was just. Yeah, that's Shawn just wanting to stick it to Brett, and somebody backstage should have had the balls to say no, but for whatever reason, they thought that Shawn was they thought that Shawn was untouchable, and then Shawn was always doing stuff that was best for business, and then by doing that, it's at that point that Shawn realizes that he's probably untouchable, because they've never given him any reason to think otherwise, and that just sort of was the it dotted the I, it crossed the T, and put the full stop at the end of that that sentence. So yeah, this was the one night only as the peak toxicness of Shawn Michaels in 97 for me.
Yeah, he was. I mean, there were rumors about him, you know, wanting to leave, wanting to jump to join his buddies. You know, he wore the outsider shirt backstage, which I believe he did that at SummerSlam, because I remember where we were sitting, and I remember walking down, and you could see into the back, like where our seats were. Like, you could see through the curtain a little bit. You see the wrestlers walk around, because that was the part of the arena we were. And I remember, I swear to God, I saw him with the outsider shirt on. I was like, what the fuck? And I went to my buddies. I'm like, what's going on? And they're like, we had heard about him, you know, being an asshole backstage. And now I think this was around the time when him and, you know, Diesel would give each other the click signs. You know, one would, you know, Shawn would come out doing it on Raw, and then, and, you know, you'd hear right back at you, HBK, you know, on Nitro. I mean, rumors of him, like, you know, oh, I'm going to, you know, get in a car and drive to Atlanta, whatever. I mean, I think they were probably also, you know, afraid Shawn was going to jump. I mean, I'm sure his contract was probably secure, but, you know, I think there was a time that they were probably, like, concerned about that.
Yeah, I do think that's that. There is an element to that as well, that Shawn knew that the WWF needed him more than he needed the WWF, because if it was ever to go south, with McMahon, he could get a plane, go down to Atlanta, and Eric Bischoff would have a contract waiting for him before he'd even got off the flight. And I think there was a few guys like that. You're probably looking at Brett would have known that. The Undertaker would have known it, but they were sort of loyal to the end. Obviously, maybe not Brett in a couple of weeks after that, but for all intents and purposes, I don't think he particularly wanted to leave. But you get the impression with Shawn that if they showed him the door, he'd be out in a heartbeat, and in the first. In his car and racing at breakneck speed down to Atlanta to sign with WCW. So I think he sort of had them over a barrel in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what are your thoughts on the first ever Hell in a Cell?
Perfection. No other word I can put for it. This was my number one match in the GWWE. I think it's absolutely excellent, and very few of the Hell in a Cells, if any, have got as close to this one. It's not, for obvious reasons, it's not as well remembered as King of the Ring 1998, but as a match, I think there's very few flaws to it. And again, it's another one, like the ladder match. Yeah, I could put this on at any time, and it holds up just as well in 2021 as it did in 97.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's one of these ones that if it happened today, it would break the... Meltzer would be giving it 6.5 stars. It would break the 5-star scale, but it certainly does for me.
Oh, yeah. So it did get a 5-star from Big Dave. So in that fall... Shawn joins forces with his best friend there, Triple H, and his Triple H's then girlfriend Chyna and Rick Rude to form probably one of the greatest stables of all time, D-Generation X, in its original form. Now, it does have other forms, as talked about on the Triple H episode, actually the debut episode with Scott Criscolo. We went well into depth about the many incarnations, but Sean was really, you know, was in his, this was really his heyday. I mean, they do, we'll talk about the when it comes back later on, but you know, he continues his rivalry with Brett, and this time now, you know, Brett is the heel everywhere except for Canada, in the Pro Canada Heart Foundation. I really love this feud. I mean, Sean was like, you know, he was like an anti-hero basically at this time, where, you know, he was an asshole, but you were rooting for him because you were booing Brett basically. So then Survivor Series 97 comes about, and it's Sean and Brett, and, you know, backstage contracts and stuff happen to the point where Brett, you know, had signed a big long-term deal with WWF, and then, you know, they had to, you know, rework it or let him out of the deal somehow. And then he goes on and he signs with WCW. And so basically on Monday, the day after Survivor Series, Eric Bischoff was prepared to go on live television and say they had signed the WWF champion. So Vince, you know, needed to get the belt off of Bret Hart. Brett is a business guy, and he said he would have dropped it to anybody except for Sean because of their, you know, their rivalry, their dislike for each other. And we get the famous Montreal screw job where Sean, you know, they have a match. Sean puts Brett into the sharpshooter. You know, Dave Ebner calls, was it Earl? I can't remember which one. I always get them confused. I think it was Earl. Calls for the bell. Sean gets the belt and runs out of the arena basically like a thief in the night, which kind of he was. And the whole, you know, Wrestling with Shadows was getting filmed at that time. And everybody, did they know? Who knew? How many people knew? When did they know? What was going on? What's happening? You know, Brett spits in Vince's face. He punches Vince and gives him a black eye. But, you know, so Callum, you know, you weren't watching live yet when DX was initially formed. So you went back and watched it. What did you think of DX as a formation?
I really, really like the first incarnation of it, where it was just the small group. It seemed more, I mean, as much as the second one with X-Pac and the Outlaws and Chyna, excuse me. I do like the makeup of it in this first one, especially Rick Rude, because looking at what DX became, Rick Rude being in DX right at the very start, that he does stick out like a sore thumb. but I think it was all. It's not like I am not comparing DX in any way, shape, or form to the Four Horsemen, other than that it seemed like it was a group that was designed to make sure that Shawn Michaels kept the WWF Championship. Mm-hmm. Got it and kept it, and that's where the similarities to the Horsemen begin and end. But I wonder if it was part of to keep Shawn happy. I imagine it was as part of a ploy to keep Shawn happy that he gets to work with his friends all every night.
And he kind of gets to be like an asshole. On screen, like with the moons and the press conferences, and you know being that you know, the anti-authority figure, you know, you know again, like you had mentioned about Steve Austin and he turning it up to 11 basically, and he was just be as the great Andrew Dice Clay says in Four Lane, getting paid to be the asshole you always were. That's what kind of that's what DX kind of seemed like to me.
Yeah, well, I think was one of the many DX documentaries that they've done. It's they just did the stuff that they were doing backstage in front of the camera, and if that is the case, you can see why loads of guys didn't particularly get on well with them, because they were just insufferable, but insufferable in an entertaining way in front of the for sort of us watching. But I really liked him. I've always really liked DX up until probably the reunions. It was, you know, ever diminishing returns for that.
Yeah. So then talk about the screw job. Because honestly, I mean, who else at the time could he have dropped the belt to? Vader? Really? I mean, I don't know.
I think Brett maybe deep down wanted to drop it to Shamrock.
Oh yeah.
I think because on his way out, he's dropping it to somebody that, because he doesn't want to be looking like a chump going into WCW. I think if he can spin it that he lost it to a cage fighter potentially. Everybody was at fault in this one, and I might not make many friends by saying that I think Brett's probably as much to fault as anybody else. It was the perfect storm, really. You have Sean, who is such an asshole that Brett doesn't want to lose it to him in the first place. But as you say, he's born and bred in the wrestling business, so he knows that if he needs to drop it to Sean, he will do it. He will do it through gritted teeth, but he doesn't want to do it in Canada, which is a pride thing for him. He was happy to do it. Was it Springfield, Massachusetts was the next house show or something? He said he would do it there. He would do it on Raw the next night because it was in Buffalo or something. So he would anywhere but Canada. He was throwing everything back. Every idea they were thrown back at him, he was thrown back at him. Vince was probably as much to blame as anybody because he signed a contract that allowed him this reasonable creative control. Now, what reasonable is very subjective in this instance, but it is what it is. Yeah, it was just that there was no good way of doing this other than Michaels laying down for him. Brett was never going to be happy unless he beat Shawn Michaels 1-2-3 in the middle of the ring. Shawn Michaels was never going to let that happen at the time. It was a perfect storm of shit that was coming towards them. To be honest, they did back themselves into a corner with it. It's just one of these things, and I'm not one of these people that thinks it's. I'm sure there's. Is it Scott Hall thinks it was a work, but it was definitely not a work. This was 100% real, and it just. They backed themselves. Everybody backed themselves into a corner, and it was never going to end well. But as you said, there was nobody else really. The Undertaker's just going to go into his thing with Kane. He's not going to win the belt. There's nobody. Not Vader. They've made to look like crap for a year. There's no one else. You're not going to give it to Steve Austin because you're building him up for his big moment at WrestleMania. So there is literally no one else that they could, other than maybe Shamrock. There's literally no one else they could do it with.
Yeah. You know, as a good friend of mine says, Vince did what he had to do, basically. You know, there was no way around it.
I agree with that. I think he did what he felt was the best thing to do. But on that night, but it was entirely avoidable before it got to that night.
Yep. So then we get to the Royal Rumble 98, where Shawn once again takes on The Undertaker, this time in a casket match. And this is a match that changes the course of Shawn's career, where he takes a back body drop outside the ring onto the casket, costing him to herniate two discs and crush one completely. He goes on to win the match, but then he was unable to compete on the following months, No Way to Texas in Your House, and he was forced into retirement a night after losing it to Stone Cold Steve Austin at WrestleMania 14. He goes away for nearly 4 months, but is still like, present. You know, he comes back as the commissioner, eventually joins, the corporation, and he makes several appearances. And on the January 4th, 1999 episode of Raw, he rejoined DX as a face, but then disappears for a few weeks to have back surgery. By the time he returned, DX was on its way of dissolving within the next couple of months. So talk about this casket match and your feelings on Sean, basically being out of the ring for a significant amount of time.
When I first saw the casket match, I obviously get into it with the benefit of hindsight. I knew this was the moment that it all went wrong for him, like with his back. But it was just one of these moments. It just seemed like very innocuous. Like if he had gone a couple inches higher, he would have hit his ass on the casket and he'd have been fine. A couple inches lower, he might have grazed it. But he just seemed to hit the casket in completely the wrong... I mean, I don't know. This might have been like a one in a million injury that he just hit it in the wrong place, and it caused him so much... Like, it caused, like, devastation to his back. It's all very... All very, very unfortunate. You can tell he's not comfortable for the rest of the match, but he powers through. But yeah, it's just one freak accident changes him. Well, the course of Shawn Michaels for 4 years and beyond. Yeah, it was just. But that's all. That's all it really was. It was just a freak accident.
Yeah. And then he goes on, though, he does have the match at Mania against Austin, which, cements Austin. You have the great, turn by Tyson, and, he powers through that match. I mean, you watch that now, you just kind of think, like, how he did it with the back the way it was. What are your thoughts on that match?
For the state that Sean was in, I think that the match was much better than it had any God-given right to be, because his back was like completely fucked. But he's thrown himself, and they go up to the DX bandstand, and he's getting hit with all their drum kit equipment, and he's taking all these bumps in his back. And I remember at one point he throws himself back first into the turnbuckle, like with so much force. I'm thinking, you're doing more damage to the back than your back is already there, and your back at this point is completely, as you said, is like he's two or three of his vertebrae are just completely gone. It's a miracle that the guy could even stand, and he's out here doing all this to put on the best match he can, and because it's the main event of WrestleMania, because he is, and I think at this point he's genuinely thinking he is Mr. WrestleMania. He's the showstopper and the main event, and he wants to go out there and show everybody that he's one of the best in the world. But you've got I do cringe sometimes watching the match, knowing how his back was going into that and what he's doing to his back during that match.
Yeah. It's still amazing that he gets through it. Yeah. And it was, more than it needed to be. So he, has to retire with this injury, and, he does appear on television. He still appears, in the zeitgeist and, not Zeitgeist. I mean, he's like still in everybody's purview, and he goes on to start a wrestling academy in Texas, which kind of like keeps him going, and he starts to rehab and gets back in the ring there, and he makes his return after an 18-month absence in 2002 on the June 3rd episode of Monday Night Raw, where Kevin Nash, after, this is after WCW closed, and the big-time contracts were all over, so the big guys appeared in there, and they announced Shawn as the new member of the recently reformed New World Order. And I hated this, personally. I was like, you know what? Shawn always wanted to be in the NWO, and they just did this to make him happy. He comes out, like, you know, with a little bit of a different look, you know, a little older. And, what are your thoughts on this brief run as Shawn in the NWO?
At the time, or just now, I'll say, I think it's shoehorned to try and make the NWO relevant. And yes. just in the WWE, because they didn't do much since WrestleMania 18. They hadn't done much with the NWO to make them seem like they were a relevant group. I think they did it to add a bit of spice to it. At the time, I thought it was excellent, because, and I can remember, it was a Friday night. We used to get Raw. We get Raw live now on a Monday, but at that point in time, you had to be all the way to Friday to get it. And we didn't, I think at that point, we had just got the internet, but I didn't know what, like, I wasn't entrenched in wrestling internet at that point. So Friday night was the first time I would see Raw and know what happened, and Saturday morning for SmackDown. But so I remember watching it, and then they're introducing, they're doing this big thing that we're going to introduce the newest member of the NWO, and out pops Shawn Michaels. And I was stunned. I think I wouldn't be the only person that was stunned, but I was stunned in a good way, because this is, as I said, this is a guy that's just sort of been, I only knew as a character in a video game, and people have told me that he's really good. So I thought that this was excellent. But with the benefit of hindsight, knowing what I know now, I was a bit naive, but. To me,
I'm like, well, this is when you first started watching it. I could imagine you popping for that, but as somebody who had, you know, watched all the way through the Monday Night Wars, it's like, oh yeah, Shawn finally gets his NWO T-shirt. That's what I thought it was. Yeah. They're just there to make Shawn happy.
Yeah, I mean, with 19 years, nineteen years later, you're just going, this is polishing a turd a bit. But at the time, I thought it was the best thing ever.
Yes. So then, then we get the NWO disbands after a little time here, and we get a Triple H makes amends with Shawn Michaels. Michaels' plea, which Triple H to return to Raw. They come down to the ring, sporting a DX music and attire. They're about to perform the Suck It taunt when Triple H turns on Shawn Michaels, and again, I loved this turn, by the way. And this feud, I mean, this was really an awesome feud. They have a storyline with a street fight, a non-sanctioned match at SummerSlam. And this is, Triple H, is really getting, the usage of the sledgehammer now. And then we have another show that I was at, a Survivor Series, where Shawn wins the heavyweight title from Triple H, the first ever Elimination Chamber. I couldn't believe that Shawn had come back, honestly. Talk about this feud with Triple H, because I thought this was a great feud, in my opinion.
The 2002 version of this, I absolutely love. The turn, the build up to SummerSlam was excellent. As much as I think the Hell in a Cell is the best match in WWE history, as voted for in a GWE anyway. The SummerSlam Unsanctioned is my favourite match of all time. I just think the story going into it, the story through the match, Triple H is just completely wailing on Shawn's back, to the point where Jerry Lawler, who is Triple H's biggest fan at this point in time, is urging Shawn to fight back. The whole package of that to what happened in the ring, to the commentary, it was just excellent. And it was the strangest thing. So, I can't remember at the time, but I think SummerSlam was meant to be a one-off, and then we always seem to get a series of, okay, I'll do one more with Sean. So he proved that he could still do it at SummerSlam at a very good level, and all credit to Triple H, because having not been in a match for 4 years on that stage, even Shawn Michaels must have wondered, and Shawn Michaels has got as much confidence in himself as anybody, but he must have thought that could he still do it? And so to have him, he had the perfect dance partner for that. Then you'll go, right, we'll go one more for Survivor Series. And again, when he won the World Heavyweight title at that in the first Elimination Chamber, I was stunned.
Were stunned. We were not expecting him to win.
No, I was stunned. I was ecstatic, because it was just this like, I remember watching it, because it was one of these ones. It was at school on the Monday morning, but my dad would always tape it for me. And that morning after Survivor Series, I made a point to get up early, because I'm even to this day, I'm terrible at getting up in the morning, but I wanted to see what happened. And I've fast forwarded to the end, watched the last 5 minutes of the chamber, and then watched the whole show when I got home, because I wanted to see what happened at the end. And it was just, yeah, it was excellent. And again, it was just the whole Shawn Michaels only had one match in 4 years. He was out for, that had been 3 months, because Triple H put a sledgehammer to his back at the end of Survivor Series, and now he's the only person that's between that can stop Triple H leaving as the champion. Again, the story from the turn to the end of Survivor Series, I think, was excellent, and they hit it was spot on every step of the way.
I was in awe, because I never thought, you know, we were gonna see that. Then, you know, his reign as champion comes to an end a month later when he loses to Triple H in the Three Stages of Hell match, and then at Armageddon. And then he moves on to a rivalry with Chris Jericho after Chris Jericho had claimed that he was the next Shawn Michaels. Jericho wins a Battle Royal to select the entry number in a Royal Rumble, choosing number 2 in order to start the match with him, which Shawn had already been named the number 1 at the Rumble. Jericho, with the help of Christian, eliminates Shawn, and then Shawn later interferes in the match, causing Jericho to get eliminated. Michaels goes on to defeat Jericho at WrestleMania 19. Despite this, he was lowboat after hugging Jericho. So this feud with Jericho, you know, what are your thoughts on it?
I really like this one as well, and this is, I wonder at what point here did Shawn decided that he was going to be back full time, because after he did Survivor Series, somebody must have gotten his ear and goes, right, how about one last WrestleMania, and we'll put you against Jericho. And I certainly remember everyone used to say that, or seeing stuff that people would say, that Jericho is the new Shawn Michaels. So this was a bit of a dream match, for me anyway, going into 19. The Jericho trying to emulate the everything Shawn had done by being number 2 in the Rumble, and just trying to emulate Shawn but do it one better. Was great, and the match they had made my GWWE match list as well. I cannot speak highly enough for the match. I think it's a great one. In a show with two or three great matches on it. That's one of them. It's one of the better ones on that one. They had a great match and a great WrestleMania, and you can't get much better than that.
Yeah. So then, we go on to December on Raw, where Shawn seemingly defeats Triple H in San Antonio with Eric Bischoff as special guest referee. However, Bischoff reversed the decision, declared the match a draw due to both men's shoulders being on the mat. Angered by this, Michaels attacks Flair and Bischoff. He was subsequently fired by Bischoff, but rehired by Stone Cold Steve Austin. And then he goes on and continues his feud with Triple H. The two competed alongside Chris Benoit in the main event, WrestleMania 20, another show I was at. Benefits of growing up in the tri-state area, Calum, not because I'm I'm special, just having to grow up in an area where there are a lot of big wrestling shows. which I really, really enjoyed. Both of them come up short. Benoit wins the championship that night. They have a rematch at Backlash in Edmonton, where Benoit successfully retains, forcing Shawn to submit in the sharpshooter. The Edmonton crowd booed Shawn due to the Montreal screw job, with chance of "you screwed Bet" being heard loud during this match. Then at Bad Blood in June, he loses to Triple H in Hell in a Cell. 4 months later, he lost a World Heavyweight Championship match against Triple H after Edge interfered at Taboo Tuesday, when the fans voted him voted for him ahead of Edge and Chris Benoit to take on Triple H. Following this, Shawn was out of action. Sorry, late. It's late. Late for Callum, even worse. Following this, Michaels out of action for a few months with a torn meniscus. So, Callum, talk about WrestleMania 20, where the triple threat match with Benoit and Triple H. What are your thoughts on that match?
Well, at this point, I was on the Benoit bandwagon. Mm-hmm. At this point,
a lot of people were. Me included too.
Yeah, I mean, again, it was one of these ones that was everything was pointing towards Benoit winning. It was a bit of a foregone conclusion, but again, not giving people what they want isn't the worst thing in the world. I thought the match was the match was excellent. I think all three guys got the shine that they deserved at that point in the build up. They made Benoit look excellent for his big moment. And as WrestleMania main events go, I mean it is one of the better ones. Every guy pulled their weight. I don't go out of my way to watch it, but if I was to, for whatever reason, put WrestleMania 20 on, I would look forward to it rolling round, because it is an excellent match.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then we move on to the Royal Rumble 2005, where he competes and he eliminates Kurt Angle. And seeking revenge, Kurt re-enters the ring and eliminates Shawn. He plays him in the ankle lock outside the ring. He then issued a challenge to Angle at WrestleMania 21, which Angle accepted when he appeared on Raw. Now, I popped big time for the following week when it was they had the Raw reunion and they had Marty and Shawn reunite as the Rockers. Mm-hmm. They came out to the music, everything. I honestly popped big time for that. I have to admit, I am seriously. I am a Rockers mark for sure. So what do you think of his little feud here with Kurt?
I mean, what as dream matches go, Shawn and Kurt is probably it's probably right up there with ones that when Shawn comes back, you want to tick off the list. You've got his match with Jericho, who's meant to be the next Shawn Michaels, but always there. Imagine what would happen if he was in the ring with Kurt Angle. And I don't think they ever, because Kurt, from when Shawn came back, was predominantly a SmackDown guy. I don't think he was ever really on Raw at that point. Mm-hmm. So they never crossed paths, and you're just at the back of your mind, what if they were face Kurt? What if it was to face Kurt? And like WrestleMania 21, like as you said, the build up to it was superb. So Kurt Angle was trying to again emulate everything that Sean had done, but had done it a bit better. So he had the ladder match for his medals. He had the match with Marty, but it obviously led to the Monday before the Rockers reunion to get Marty in like quote unquote ring shape for the following Thursday. Mm-hmm. It was excellent to the point where I think Marty managed to get himself a contract at the end of it.
Yeah.
Because he performed so well, but the build up to WrestleMania 21 and the match, I mean, what could I say about the match that hasn't been said before? It is absolutely, it's everything that you would expect from the two of them.
Uh-huh.
They brought it that night and just it was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, they even bring Sherry in to that.
Forgot about that one. Yeah, that's
yeah. Yeah. So then, you know, following the events of WrestleMania 21, next night on Raw, Muhammad Hassan and Daivari come out to confront and assault Shawn Michaels on April 11th. He approached Eric Bischoff, demanded a handicap match with the two of them. He scheduled the match, and, you know, he refused to schedule such a match and instead told him to find a partner. Michaels then made a plea for Hulk Hogan to come back and return on the April 18th episode of Raw. Hassan again led attack on Michaels until Hogan appeared to make the save and accept his offer. At Backlash, they beat Hassan and Daivari when Daivari was pinned. Later on, in a WrestleMania rematch, Shawn Michaels defeats Kurt Angle, who was drafted to Raw in the draft lottery at Vengeance. On July 4th episode, Michaels and Hogan had a tag team match against Carlito and Kurt Angle. During the post-match, Michaels hit Hogan with switchy music, knocking Hogan to the ground and turning heel for the first time since 1998. The following week on Raw, Michaels appeared on Piper's Pit, where he superkicked Roddy Piper and then challenged Hogan to a match at SummerSlam, which Hogan accepted the following week. Hogan defeated Shawn Michaels at SummerSlam. After the match, he extended his hand, saying, "I needed to know, and I found out." And he and Hogan shook hands. He left the ring, allowed Hogan to celebrate with the crowd, turning face once again. Now, this is the part where you know, Shawn just goes, he's at this point in his career where, you know, I think he's matured. I think he's, you know, I don't know if he had met his wife as well as I think it's his second wife, where he, you know, he became like a born again. I don't know if he's a born again Christian or found God or whatever the hell. But you know, he understood, like, you know, look, I have to play the heel here because Hogan, we need him to be, you know, a Hulkster. We need Hulkamania, Hulk Hogan here. And I need to be the heel. I'm going to do the job. I mean, you know, a match you never thought you would see if you went back to, like, you know, the early 90s. You never thought you'd see Hogan and Shawn in a huge match. But there they were. And I really enjoyed this. I loved his turn here. You know, it was a little, you know, reminiscent of the turn on Marty, but it still came off really well. And I you know, I love this. I loved Hogan in this, too. So what do you think of, you know, the whole buildup where they use Hassan and Daivari to get Hogan back, mm-hmm. you know, in to the thing, to kind of a long way to four month journey here to get this SummerSlam match.
It was a roundabout way to get there, but the turn, was it the 4 week heel turn that he had?
Yes.
It was excellent. I mean, the turn that they made, or he made, that they did on Raw was excellent, and you didn't see it coming because Shawn had been this returning legend, and he'd been in that character for the 2.5 years since he came back, and you just thought that was him and his run, that from now to whenever he gave it up, he would just be. It would be the legend that everybody cheered, because at this point in time, who wants to boo Shawn Michaels? But he made people boo him. And he just reverted back to it, and it showed you how good he was, that he could just, at the flick of a switch, just turn back into 1997 Shawn Michaels. Because I don't know if you remember, they had the show, did they have a show in Montreal? They definitely had it in Canada, and Shawn is in the ring talking about how he screwed Bret, and then they play Bret Hart's music, And he acts like the chicken shit that he's absolutely crapping himself that Brett might come, and then it stops, and he just turns around to him and goes, "Do you really think I was going to let him turn up?" or something like that. And it was just excellent. I mean, he was just such a shit. But I think it was perfect. And you made a great point that he's at this point in time, he has matured. He's Shawn Michaels 2.0, and he's now married to his second wife, and he's now, you know, he's a different guy. And he understood that you can't, especially after seeing WrestleMania 18. Hulk Hogan's not going to be booed by that crowd, so somebody's got to play the heel, and Sean was gracious enough to play the heel. I say gracious enough to play the heel. He was great up until the match. He was gracious enough to play the heel, and then the match happens, and we all know what happens during the match with Sean's antics. But the build up to it was excellent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then, you know, on December 26, 2005, on Raw, that Vince lauds Michaels for his part in the screw job, saying Michael said he was loyal to his company and he had moved on. Michael said he should move on. McMahon said he should move on as well. McMahon then began setting unusual stipulations for Michaels' matches and interfering on behalf of his opponents. During the Royal Rumble, Vince made his way to the ring, and as Shawn stared at him, Shane returns, making a surprising appearance, eliminates Shawn from the match on February 13th that year. On Raw, McMahon tried to unsuccessfully force Shawn to sign retirement papers. The following week, Michaels won a handicap match against the Spirit Squad. And after the match, his former partner Marty Jannetty comes down to help him from being assaulted by a Spirit Squad. After they reunite, McMahon offered Jannetty a contract if he kissed his ass. The following week, Jannetty refused and instead took Chris Masters' Master Lock Challenge. He tried to help Michaels comes down to help Jannetty, which ultimately resulted in Shane attacking Shawn and forcing him to kiss his father's behind. On Saturday night's main event, Shane defeated Shawn Michaels in a street fight after he applied a sharpshooter on Michaels, which led Vince immediately ordering for the bell to be rung, even though Shawn did not submit, and with an allusion to the screw job. Despite interference from the Spirit Squad and Shane, Shawn defeats Vince at WrestleMania 22 at a No Holds Barred match. At Backlash, the McMahons defeat Shawn and God in a tag team match with help from the Spear Squad in no DQ match. On the May 22nd episode of Raw, the Spear Squad was scripted to injure Michael's knee. The angle is written so that Shawn could have surgery at the time, which had legitimately had been injured for quite some time. So, again, one of his nicknames we have not mentioned is Mr. WrestleMania. And, you know, he has, you know, another lead up to another WrestleMania match with you know, his feud with Vince. What are your thoughts on this feud and the WrestleMania match?
I've said a couple of times now that when he came back in 2002, you've got a list of these dream matches that you thought would you wanted to happen. Vince McMahon was never near the top of the list on dream matches that I wanted to see, but. I've said it in a few places now that Vince McMahon, for being a non-wrestler and for being an older gentleman, to put it nicely, he must be the best wrestler they've ever had, because his ratio of matches to good matches, is incredibly high. Be able to pull out a good match, and WrestleMania 22 was one of those. I think I enjoyed it. I mean, it came out of, well, to me anyway, it came out of nowhere that Vince and Shawn were going to have this feud. So it was one of these ones, but eventually Vince McMahon having a garbage match is, you know, yeah, it's always going to be at least watchable. And as I said, not high in the priority of my dream matches, but certainly not a bad match by any stretch.
Yeah. So, and it actually doesn't end here, though, this feud. You know, a series of events takes place in 2006, where the reunion of DX is getting teased between Shawn and Triple H, where they both perform the crotch chop during their matches at WrestleMania 22. Vince McMahon, Triple H, Michael's feud with Vince McMahon, Triple H goes on to challenge John Cena for the WWE Championship, repeatedly bumping heads with Vince in the process. On June 12th of that year on Raw, DX officially reunites during Triple H's gauntlet match, which he had him compete against the Spirit Squad. Shawn comes down to help Triple H, and the two did the crotch chops, at Vengeance. They defeat Spirit Squad in a 5-on-2 handicap match. They also defeat them at Saturday night's main event, and then defeated the McMahons at SummerSlam at Unforgiven. DX once again defeated McMahons and ECW, then ECW World Champion, The Big Show, in a Hell in a Cell match that concluded the feud. So, did you pop big time for the DX reunion?
I did at this point, yeah. I liked it here because it was something like I'd never seen DX in their heyday. And obviously you get two of the, by this point in time, you get two of the biggest stars that they've got. I was pumped for it. I'm not going to lie, but again, as it would turn out, it's the first time round was good. As it went on, it became less and less appealing. But I was 100%. I was all in for the first DX reunion at this time.
Yeah, I kind of really like this feud between them and the McMahons, with the Spirit Squad basically being the patsies the whole time. So then at Cyber Sunday, DX takes on Rey at RKO. The fan-selected referee Eric Bischoff allowed the illegal use of a steel chair to give RKO the win, and being the first tag team to defeat DX in a rematch since their reformation. As far as series, however, the DX emerged victorious against RKO in a clean sweep victory at New Year's Revolution. Triple H suffered a legit torn right quad injury during their match. Ray RKO claimed victory over DX, citing Triple H's injury at the end of DX. On January 15th, Shawn lived up to his word of dealing with Ray RKO from his comments from the previous week when he took out Randy Orton with a concerto. And after a handicap match with Edge and Orton, he then goes on to capture the World Tag Championships with John Cena after defeating RKO. And then he defeated Edge and Orton in a triple threat number one contenders match on February 5th to earn a shot at the championship at WrestleMania 23. He faces John Cena, who retains the championship. So let's pause here for a moment. And so Shawn, Triple H goes out, and that kind of cuts the whole DX thing short. And, you have him feuding with Randy Orton, and then goes on to face Cena at WrestleMania. Where do you put that Cena WrestleMania match in terms of Shawn's his WrestleMania matches? Where do you rank that?
It's certainly up there. John Cena, we found out, has the ability to have very, very good matches. And at this point in time, you're almost at the peak of the John Cena hatred. But Shawn is, if you're wanting to put on a spectacle for the main event of WrestleMania, Shawn Michaels is one of the guys that you want to, one of the guys that you would, as a first ballot, you will want him in that match to make sure you get a good match at the main event of WrestleMania. And the two of them, more than delivered.
Uh-huh. And then you get that that four way later on at Backlash, where with the great finish where Cena retains it when Shawn performs Sweet Chin Music on him, which causes him to fall on Orton for the pin. He then enters a feud with Randy Orton, and the week before their scheduled match at Judgment Day, he wins a match against then heavyweight champion Edge. Orton attacks him, punting Michaels in the head. Orton then assaults Michaels again prior to their match at Judgment Day, interrupting his pre-match, his interview segment. He collapsed during the match, causing Orton to win by referee stoppage. Afterwards, Orton continues the beating when he performed an RKO to a fall on Michaels, who was then taken from the ring in a stretcher. During the feud, he suffered a storyline concussion. The injury was used to keep Michaels out of action as it required surgery for his knee again. He made his return on October 8th, episode of Raw, performing Sweet Chin Music to the newly crowned WWE champion, Randy Orton, during his title ceremony at the end of the show, and then celebrating over the knocked out champion as Vince watched. At Cyber Sunday, Shawn was voted by the fans to face Orton for the WWE Championship, though he won via disqualification when he was hit with a low blow by Orton. He then got another opportunity at the championship when he was granted his rematch against Randy Orton at Survivor Series. In their match, Michaels was banned from using Sweet Chin Music upon request by Orton, referring to Michaels super kicking Orton the week before. Michaels loses the match when Orton performed the RKO to win, which ended their feud. So I don't remember much about this feud with Orton, but you know, from what I understand, what I can remember, the little bit I can remember, is that this was another step in the Legend Killer for Randy. But what are you have any thoughts to share on this his feud here with Orton?
It seems to be Shawn Michaels' role in 2007 is to step in when other people can't do, like, are injured. So he steps in for Triple H, which was apparently meant to be the main event of WrestleMania 23 with Cena, but obviously he can't do it because he's quad injury. And I believe this is the time where the Orton is the champion at this point after Cena has to vacate and they have the three title matches at No Mercy, where he trades it back and forth with Triple H. But I would imagine that John Cena is the man to face Orton going out of at Cyber Sunday and potentially even Survivor Series. But Michaels has to step in again because Cena can't perform because of his injury. So again, safe pair of hands to put in. And yeah, if you're building up the Legend Killer, Shawn Michaels is, as we said before, he's in that role where he is the legend that's always going to perform for you. He's always going to get cheered, and that's another notch for Orton to take Michaels out.
Mm-hmm. And then that moves us on to WrestleMania 24 with one of my favorite Shawn moments. Here is, you know, he's in the he faces Ric Flair in a career threatening match, and you know, Flair, for being his age and everything, you know, does put on a decent match. And I just, the moment at the end though, I mean, every time I kind of get like, I'm starting to get goosebumps now talking about it. Just with Shawn setting up the you know, you see a beaten down Flair, he's given everything he can, he just doesn't have, you know, doesn't have anything in the tank. He doesn't have the tools anymore. Shawn setting up for the Sweet Chin Music, and he just goes, you know, I'm sorry, I love you, and then, you know, hits him with the Sweet Chin Music, pins him, ends Rick's in-ring career. And what a moment, you know, that I don't think anybody else besides Shawn could have done this. What are your thoughts on the Flair match and that moment?
Yeah, I mean, that is, you talk about WrestleMania moments, and that is, I mean, that is top five, top ten. It is just excellent. Last weekend, as we're recording this, myself, Scott, Dr. G, and Sean did the NWA 73 watch on Twitch, and Ric Flair was our special guest, and he made a point of thanking Shawn Michaels. He was talking about his career, and he made a point of thanking Shawn Michaels for dragging him to, I think at this point he would have been 50, did he say he was 56 or 58? And he said he dragged him to one of the best matches of his career, and what a way to go out. And he thanked Shawn Michaels for it, because Flair didn't want to go out on a whimper. And Shawn made sure that he didn't. The whole thing was excellent. Michaels obviously idolizing Flair growing up, and the conflict that he was having in his own head about whether to beat, because he is Mr. WrestleMania, he does want to win at WrestleMania, that's what he does, but also knowing that if he wins at WrestleMania, that's it for Ric Flair. I'm sorry, I love you, that is just, if that was ad-libbed by Sean at that point in time, that's why he's one of the, another reason why he's one of the best. And if it wasn't, whoever came up with that, deserves to be in the Hall of Fame, genuinely, yeah. Because it is just a perfect spot for that point in time.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I just again get goosebumps whenever I talk about it, whenever I see it. It's incredible. So then he moves on, to feud with Batista after this happens because. You know, Batista calls him selfish and egotistical. They face off at Backlash with Jericho as the guest referee. Sean, fakes a knee injury, then performs sweet chin music and wins. Jericho then confronts Sean, in which Michaels admitted to faking the injury in order to defeat Batista. Michaels goes on to defeat Jericho at Judgment Day. At One Night Stand, Shawn Michaels loses to Batista in a stretcher match, ending their feud. And then on Raw, in another great moment with Sean. He's attacked by Chris Jericho during his talk segment, the highlight reel, being thrown directly through a television screen. Kind of, reminiscent of when he turns on Marty and puts Marty through the glass. In the storyline, Sean suffers a detached retina at the Great American Bash, between Michael and Jericho scheduled, in which Jericho assaults Sean's eyes, which caused Jericho to win by referee stoppage. A month later at SummerSlam, Sean announces his retirement from pro wrestling. That night, Jericho punched Sean's wife in the face. And then on the August 25th episode of Raw, he renounces retirement and challenges Jericho to an unsanctioned match at Unforgiven, which Jericho accepts. Then the next week, they have an in-ring contract signing. During this, they start a fight, causing a legit small triceps tear for Sean. He was medically cleared to compete at Unforgiven, so beat Jericho so severely that the referee called the match, making Michaels the winner. Later that night, Jericho replaced CM Punk in the World Heavyweight Championship Scramble and won the title. The next month at No Mercy, Sean loses a ladder match for the World Heavyweight Championship to Jericho. And then in December, Sean was written into a storyline where he lost his family savings due to a recession and reluctantly accepted a one-year general employment contract from JBL. After failing to help JBL win the World Heavyweight title from Cena at the Rumble, and being derided for it, he agrees to face JBL all or nothing at No Way Out. He then defeats JBL, laying out his contract early while still receiving full payment. So what do you think of this period of time where he's kind of going up against, going through all the top guys right now? We got Batista. He has another, feud with Jericho, and then with JBL. Which of these stands out to you?
Absolutely the Jericho one. I mean, this is I think other than maybe that first year going from SummerSlam 2002 to Survivor Series 03, this might be Sean's best year of his comeback, because the whole Jericho thing throughout the whole year, I mean, it obviously starts off with Flair, and then it moves into the story where Batista and Jericho are pissed at him because he retired Flair. About the Jericho thing running the whole year, and every single stop of it, they hit a home run. The unsanctioned match at Unforgiven, it made my GWE list as well. I mean, it's just. The whole story surrounding that, you understood, or you came across as it was a proper blood feud, So from certainly from WrestleMania, the Flair one up until No Mercy, Sean was just on fire with everything. Not a huge fan of the whole JBL thing at the end of the year. It just seemed to come out of nowhere. After having this blood feud, you get this story that JBL is now his benefactor because he's lost all his savings due to the financial crisis. I didn't It was a strange turn of events for him, but up until that point, everything was excellent.
Yep. So then, on March 22nd on Raw, Shawn becomes the first person to defeat Vladimir Kozlov, and he earns a match with the Undertaker at WrestleMania 25. The Undertaker defeated Shawn in a highly acclaimed match to extend his WrestleMania winning streak to 17-0. After WrestleMania, Shawn took a hiatus from the WWE. So, what are your thoughts on this match, with the Undertaker?
I don't know what more I could add to what everyone's saying. I mean, it's just one of the best matches in WrestleMania history. Mm-hmm. It's one of the best matches that the company have ever put on. I personally prefer 25 to the one they had the next year. Mm-hmm. Because it was, I'm not sure that they had, I think this might have been their first match they'd had since 98. I can't remember many Undertaker Michaels matches since they came back, if there was any. So it was just, this is at the point where the Undertaker is firing on all cylinders as well.
Yeah.
And you've just got, they just meet at the perfect time. The two of them just like made magic that night. It was superb.
Yeah. I love that match too. And so he after his hiatus, he returns in a series of segments that aired in August of 2009, where in storyline, he had left WWE. Triple H, this was funny. This is back when, I think this was around the time when they were doing the guest host, right? And Jeremy Piven referred to SummerSlam as Summerfest. And during this thing at the cafeteria, Triple H is trying to get him back for SummerSlam. And Shawn's like, I thought it was Summerfest, which was a quite funny thing. He does the sweet chin music to the girl off camera, obviously. One of the funnier bits that they had done. He agrees to tag team with Triple H to face Legacy at SummerSlam. At SummerSlam, they defeat Legacy. Their feud concludes in October. Goes on until October, 2 months later at TLC, DX defeats Jericho to win the Unified Tag Titles in the Tables, Ladders, and Chair match on the January 4th, 2010. Episode of Raw, Shawn buries the hatchet with longtime rival Bret Hart as they shake hands and hug in the ring. As a contrast, that was Storyline's feature. So this, in fact, was a real-life reconciliation, which laid to rest animosity surrounding the Montreal Screwjob. DX then goes on to lose the tag titles in a triple threat match to the team of The Miz and Big Show on the February 8th episode of Raw, which also include the Straight Edge Society, CM Punk, and Luke Gallows. At the Elimination Chamber, Shawn cost The Undertaker the World Heavyweight Championship in the main event. And then at WrestleMania, now was this was the Royal Rumble this year. That was the one where Shawn had to win, right? Was that the one where which one was the show where Shawn had to win to face the Undertaker, right? And Edge ends up winning.
Yeah. So that was the year that because the Undertaker got into the Rumble he was the champion going into the Rumble. So Shawn felt he had to win the Rumble to face the Undertaker at WrestleMania because he was determined to face him again. So he would have, if he won the Rumble, he would have chosen to face the Undertaker at WrestleMania.
So then, he does get that match, and he loses, and as a result, he was forced to retire due to the stipulation, the same way Shawn had ended Ric Flair's career. On the next night, on March 29th, on Raw, he gives an emotional farewell speech, departing with the familiar sentence, Shawn Michaels has left the building. So, what did you think of this way for Shawn, to end his, career proper here?
I can't imagine a better way of doing it. The similarities to Ric Flair. Everybody wants to go out, I imagine, having that one last great match. You don't want if you think about there's guys like Bret Hart's last match because of his concussion was like a DQ loss to somebody on Nitro. Mm-hmm. I mean, contrast that with going out having one of the best, again, another one of the best matches in WrestleMania history with The Undertaker, who is, you know, who is probably forever will be the quintessential WWF character, mm-hmm. Maybe other than Hulk Hogan. I don't think he could have, if you had asked him to write it himself, I don't think he could have written a better conclusion to it. So yeah, for loads of different reasons, I think it was the perfect way to go out. If you're going to go out on top, and go out spectacularly on top.
Yep. And Shawn, he sticks around. He appears here on television, here and there. He appears where on the January 10th, 2011 episode of Raw, where he's announced as an inductee for the Hall of Fame class that year. He gets ridiculed by Alberto Del Rio later that night, and he ends up hitting him with Sweet Chin Music. He gets inducted into the Hall of Fame on April 2nd by Triple H. They were joined by the other fellow Click members, Kevin Nash and CM Punk. He returned on June 27th, episode of Raw, where he was confronted by CM Punk and superkicked David Otunga and Michael McGillicuddy later that night. DDP special appearance was interrupted by Drew McIntyre, and he super kicks McIntyre. So, you know, he continues a presence, and he appears here and there for different reunions and all sorts of various and sundry things. He ends up taking on more of a backstage role, and ends up with coming out and during WrestleMania with he appears at Triple H Sting. I'm trying to remember that match.
It was 31. Yeah. That was the one in San Francisco.
Yeah, the one that was the great. NWO DX battle about 20 years too late. but, his appearance, though, was really cool in that one where, you have the Outsiders and Hogan going up against, X-Pac and the Outlaws. And then all of a sudden, Shawn appears and super kicks Sting, which I thought was probably one of the moments of the night. Talk about his post in ring. He'll come in and do a thing here and there. Any highlights though to his post retirement career on camera?
He does always come back. Every time there's a DX reunion, he'll be there. Yeah. Every time there's a Raw, a special edition of Raw, he'll always be there. I think the Hall of Fame. Was more than deserved. Although I didn't like what you were saying there, you mentioned there that he super kicked Drew McIntyre. I feel that was uncalled for.
I apologize.
No, it's fine. It's Sean should be apologizing actually, but I think it's probably more.
I'm just the reporter, don't he?
If I remember correctly, it was actually Drew McIntyre headbutted Shawn Michaels' foot, but never mind. One of the highlights has got to be that he's as you say the DX NWO during the Sting match at WrestleMania was a highlight, but he played he was the special ref, if you remember, for the Hell in a Cell at WrestleMania 28, the Miami one, the one with the first Rock Cena match.
Yep.
And he played that role to perfection on there, and there was a genuine point there. I thought that when he hit the super kick on the Undertaker, there was a slight part of me that thought that was it. The streak is over, and I bit on the 2.9 count. I've got a story from that one. I was watching that with them. That was the first WrestleMania that I had ever stayed up to watch live. I would just normally tape them. And we went round to my friend's house, who is a massive Undertaker fan. And he was beside himself for the whole match. And as soon as Sean hit the, that sweet chin music, he started to tear up because he thought that was it. The Undertaker was finished at that point. So that was a still real to him, damn it, moment. But I think that would be tough to be topped. The moments in there. And I think some people say that Sean, I've heard or seen that people think that Sean detracts from that match, but he doesn't really do anything much other than the sweet chin music. And I think he shouts at the Undertaker to stay down. And but no, I think it was brilliantly done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now we don't know what's happening. Because he was one of the basically the second guy in charge backstage with in NXT, with his buddy Triple H, and you could definitely tell, the way the booking and the way the guys were, the feuds and everything, how you had somebody with Sean's mind and his talent, where he was giving it to the next generation. So any words in closing as we put a bow on the career of the great Shawn Michaels? Anything that we haven't mentioned or haven't said that you'd like to talk about?
No, I think we've covered it all pretty well. I mean, I think it goes without saying that Shawn Michaels, and even the most ardent haters of Shawn Michaels the person, I don't think you can argue that Shawn Michaels isn't one of the best wrestlers of all time. Bell to bell, in between the ropes, he's absolutely fantastic. And it's Shawn Michaels could, it's the age old saying that you could have a great match with a broomstick, but Shawn Michaels is one of the very few that probably could. It's just, he took Chris Masters to a good match when Chris Masters was green as grass. There's probably countless others that I'm not remembering. He got a decent match out of Ahmed Johnson one time on Raw in 96. I mean, Ahmed Johnson was you're never going to mistake him for Ric Flair in ring. I think it's just Shawn Michaels, if you can separate Shawn Michaels, the person, or especially in his first run, separate Shawn Michaels, the person, and Shawn Michaels in ring, as best you can, because sometimes they melded into one. But I think he's, if you can do that, you cannot argue with his track record. And as you say, even with NXT, you can see his fingerprints all over that, because you've got guys like, for better or for worse, he'll be producing guys like Adam Cole and Johnny Gargano, and guys that his size, and he would know how to get guys that size over. And he's done that, and that those guys are perfect for that brand's niche. But as you say, we'll see what happens in the future with that one. It doesn't, at this point in time when we're recording, it doesn't sound too rosy, but we will see. But yeah, you can't argue with his track record.
Mm-hmm. One thing we mentioned was his great impression of Shane McMahon when Triple H did Vince.
I can't believe I missed that one when you asked that question there, because that whole
here comes the money, and then he's just running around and he's jumping and he falls.
he's superb, and it's over the top, but not too over the top that you don't believe it. It was so funny.
Yeah, as great as Triple H's impression of Vince is, Sean's impression of Shane is even funnier. Oh, so great. All right. Well, excellent. Thank you for sitting down and discussing your favorite wrestler with me. But before we go, kind of tell everybody where they can find you, what's your social media presence, what other pods that you can direct them to. What do you got, Callum?
So pod-wise, I am one of the tri-hosts on both the Special Relations podcast and NWA Croc and Roll. Special Relations, we just talk, for those who don't know, haven't listened, we just talk about whatever comes to our mind on any given month that we're doing it. Croc and Roll, we're actually getting back into the proper timeline stuff. So we've survived the great Peacock transition of 2021, and we're now back December 85. We're actually, as we're recording this just now, Andy, we are due to record the next episode next week. So happy to get back to that. Again, as we've recorded, we are now the weekend prior to this, we had the NWA Empower and NWA 73 Twitch live watches. If you've not subscribed to our Twitch or YouTube page, please do. Place to Be Nation, all one word, on both of those platforms. NWA 73 turned out to be our best show in terms of viewership. We actually broke the 1,000 total views for that one over the last week, so I'm immensely proud of that, and thank you to everyone who took their time to log on and listen and watch along with us. It is greatly appreciated. So yeah, Place to Be Nation, all one word, on both of them. And if you've got any requests or suggestions for either of those, YouTube or Twitch, at PTBN YouTube on Twitter is the place to go. Just hit me up on there and I'll see what I can do for you.
Yeah. One thing I haven't mentioned, Callum does run the Place to Be Nation Twitch and the Place to Be Nation YouTube, and does a tremendous job with both. So thank you. If Break Kayfabe, as one of the leaders here at Place Nation, thank you for all the work you do on that. I really do appreciate it, and it's tremendous, and you do such a great job, especially with, you know, the personalities we have here.
it sometimes can be a quite challenging one, but we do tend to The NWA shows have been good so far because they're actually giving stuff presenting stuff that we can enjoy. The SummerSlam live watch that we did a couple of weeks past, and Andy, you were on for part of that, was just, it descended into chaos really quickly because the show was just rubbish. So
we kind of feed off of what we're watching. It's you know, that kind of dictates how the conversation is going to go.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because I think we were quite reserved for WrestleMania because we enjoyed it, especially Bad Bunny. We were quite happy with Bad Bunny, but we do every WWE main show, main roster show, for better or for worse, and we've done every NWA pay per view since we've been back. We're not discounting AEW outright. It's just sometimes getting people who want to put down $50 to watch AEW. Not everybody wants to do that, which is absolutely fine by me. But if we get enough people around, AEW is certainly not off the table. So
and with everything going on with other companies, who knows what, you know, other areas we could go. As for me, I have a couple of shows here. I appreciate the Podfather let me scratch my wrestling itch. I have the wrestling version of Mickey Mount Rushmore, as well as the Great Debate wrestling version. That should be back hopefully soon as well. Over on the PlayStation Pop Experience, that is my primary home, I have lots of great podcasts over there. I have transitioned off of being the main moderator host of the pop version of Making Mount Rushmore. That will now be taken over by Steve Riddle going forward, starting in the month of October. So I had a great run for a year. I had a couple of guest hosts at times. Ben, I believe, did one, and Steve did another. It's been a tremendous, I'm still involved in the show behind the scenes, but there's only so many pods one can do and can continue to do well. So I'm going to focus on some of my other shows, like Laughing Theater, which Colin has been on, which I'll have him back on again soon. Also, Blockbuster Rewatch, which is another live watch pod. I am doing a lot of those also on Stream Lounge. So check me out over there. I will be announcing when I appear on there as early as I can. But, you know, pretty much a couple, two, three, four times a month, I'm going to try to do streams over there. And lots of other great shows, Blockbuster Rewind, Pop Goes to the Couch, Year and Pop, all will be back very soon. So, and also, before I forget, you know, check out the other great feeds as the Quadapods, as we like to call them. That is the Jenny Position. That is Jennifer Smith's great feed with you shows like You Heard About Pluto, the Journey Through Infinity, Hot Tokes, lots of great stuff over there. And the North-South Connection podcast network that is lots of great wrestling and pop culture, you know, shows WWE. You got Extreme Three-Way Dance, No Holds Barred. Jordan and Andrew Reich have a brand new AEW show, so check that out. All kinds of great stuff. And on all the other great shows here on the Place Nation Wrestling Network. Don't forget to go to placenation.com. Check out, we have great articles, you know, writers new and old. Plus, all the pods are featured on the website. It's kind of like one-stop shopping for everything that we have to offer here. So, once again, I want to say a big, big thank you to Mr. Callum McDougall for staying up until the wee hours, as he would say, over in Scotland for talking about Shawn Michaels. I am Andy Atherton. Thank you for joining us here on Evolution, and we'll check you out when we come back on our next episode. Take care. Tell me what to do.